Well, thank you so much, Scott, and for your applause. It's always good to get applause before the talk. We'll see how we go after. And I'd like to add my respect for the Wiradjuri people. When I was at St Mark's National Theological Centre every year, a Wiradjuri language school would meet more or less on our site. So it was really nice to get to know some of those people and see that aspect of their culture kind of coming alive again. Very interesting to me. And thank you so much for the invitation to be here. I'm really thankful to Sue for the offer of being able to participate in the Intellect program, and to Scott for maybe putting my name up there. I think what you're doing is brilliant. I think it's really important for Christian people to work quite hard at commenting on things that we all share as a community together, and this obviously is one of them. It's kind of a truism nowadays, isn't it, to say that we live in troubled times. Times are always troubled, actually, and we never remember how troubled they used to be, but they're troubled in particular ways right now. So we've gathered, I guess, to consider how to conduct ourselves. How do you be a person of conviction, someone who believes some things, yet also share in community with some very different others? People are hard to trust for various reasons, and when they claim something about anything, your skepticism can be quite high, and those difficulties are all amplified at the moment. And I'm sure you've heard and thought about this by the various echo chambers that we now find ourselves in, that kind of reify what we think we know and block out things that we maybe haven't heard about. So we're here to work out how we might proceed. I'm a fan of the Oxford English Dictionary, so I looked up the word civility, and it says more than this, but these are some of the things it says. It's all about good polity, the orderly state of a country, social order as distinct from anarchy and disorder, conformity to the principles of social order, behaviour befitting a citizen, good citizenship. Or another meaning, behaviour proper to the intercourse of civilised people, ordinary courtesy or politeness, as opposed to rudeness of behaviour, decent respect, consideration. So then I flip to polite, and that's, showing courteous consideration for others, courteous, mannerly, urbane. Now, you don't prove anything by putting out a definition, but as I was reading this, it struck me, who believes in these things now, actually? Once upon a time, there was not much on that list that wasn't regarded as self-evidently good. Not so much in 2026. Exhibit A. Open that effing straight, you crazy bastards, or you'll be living in hell. Just watch. Praise be to Allah. Now, that was yesterday. Now, to be fair on Mr. Trump, he is at war, and it's not a time or a place noted for its civility, a time of war, but arguably he represents a style, doesn't he, that has been with us for maybe 20 years now, and he wouldn't get away with speaking like that without the culture that underpins him. So we're in a very different place, I think, on this whole subject. I think it's a subject that covers a bunch of different aspects, really. There's a lot going on in this topic. So I'm going to throw out a whole bunch, a grab bag of suggestions that I hope are helpful. And here's where we're heading tonight. So firstly, I want to talk about politics. Just what do we mean by that word, and how does it impinge on what we're talking about? Secondly, skepticism. I'll say why I think we need to consider skepticism when we get to it. Then a sharp left turn into something that you didn't expect tonight, something about conspiracy theories. I want to talk about interests versus identity. We touched on the matter of identity in our opening little chat, me and Scott, so we'll look into that a bit more. There's a concept called the inner ring that we'll need to investigate. I want you to know your moral options. I want you to find a new political imagination, and then some steps towards civility. So it won't be easy at the moment to see how all those hang together, but we'll get there. Bear with me. So let's start with politics. This is a word that really does pick up on probably the first three lines of this definition, doesn't it? There's a lot in that definition that touches on something we might call politics. Good polity, social order, etc., citizenship, and so on. So we're in the terrain, really, of something that we might call politics. But the problem with this word politics is it has a really wide semantic range, which can sometimes make it difficult to determine what you are referring to. And I've found at least four ways that this word gets used. And probably the main way that you'll think of when you hear the word politics is in this broad area of, you know, public affairs, the fights that go on between parties, Liberal and Labor Party. I mean, there's politics around, you know, fuel supply and all that at the moment, isn't there? And drilling down a little bit more, what politicians do at their best, I guess, is to find is what's been called the art of the possible. How do you sort of get stuff moving in a society, given all the different kind of argy-bargy that you've got to deal with? So that's sort of meaning one, what we might call public affairs. But another kind of use of the word politics is a little bit more fine-grained than that, a little bit more micro than that. Some people talk about how the way we try to get each other to do things, the way we try and control each other in interpersonal relationships, is a kind of politics. And I'm guessing that if you're motivated to be here tonight, you're probably thinking particularly about these first two aspects of politics. There's a third one, the art of rule. This is a much older sort of definition of politics. The study of how people in power work with resources to make things happen. That's a little bit rarefied. You probably don't think about politics like that so much, but that's sort of the older use of the term. That's become quite much more real to me as I've lived and worked in Canberra and watched public servants and people in politics really wrestle with how to take various resources and make them work for the wider polity. But we're not going to talk about that one very much tonight. I just need to acknowledge that it's there. And fourthly, one that I'll just touch on right now, and that we'll return to toward the end of the talk. Politics is also actually an act of the imagination. When a community comes together, it has a kind of a unconscious shared agreement about how we're going to do things together. So in a funny sense, politics is also this imagination that we all carry around about how society should work. And there's the Catholic political philosopher William Kavanagh and an Anglican ethicist called Oliver O'Donovan who've had a lot to say about this. I'm not going to say too much more about that now, but we will sort of come back to that as we proceed. But as regards those first two, the personal and public affairs, you may have been hurt or bruised by some interaction at your workplace or on some social media platform where there has been some complete absence of civility, the use of words to belittle you, demonise you as somehow something other than human, dehumanise you as a kind of monster. And, you know, if you live and work in a university context, you might have experienced this in full force at some points. And, you know, believe me, Charles Sturt has a way better culture on this front than most other universities that I'm aware of. But it still happens at Charles Sturt University. Those kind of interactions with other people were political moments in that first sense. The effort to subjugate you, the effort to make you do something or not do something, by what the German philosopher of the 19th century, Friedrich Nietzsche, calls the other person's will to power. Their will to power acting in these strong-arming ways to control you. I received an email last week after I'd made a careful inquiry, and I promise you it was really careful and crafted very, very sort of gently, to the head of a firm that offers us a service where I work, and his response to me was just completely feral, insulting, full of put-downs, and really basically telling me to put it where the sun don't shine. And, you know, my first thought was, well, perhaps this is not a well man, was that bad? But when he made no response to my invitation for a conversation, my second thought was, this is a man now moving in a culture that's given him license to speak that way, a culture led by the likes of Trump. So perhaps you are here tonight for how to participate in a way out. And I only have small news for you. I can't change the internet or the president or that other man's demeanour, but I will suggest some small ways forward that I think will be quite helpful. I want to now take a turn into this related problem, which I think underlies many of our attempts at discussion with others, and that is that we've become such a low-trust society that we have a genuine and serious problem in what the philosophers call our epistemology. How do we know things? How can we know things? And the view that you cannot really ever know anything very much at all, or anything at all, is called skepticism. And we find ourselves, don't we, pretty much at sea when it comes to what to know and who to believe. And interestingly, though, this turns out to be a very nagging worry in Western thought, and it just keeps reappearing. Perhaps the earliest recorded Western skeptic is the Greek philosopher Pyrrho of Elea, 3rd century BC. Got another reboot in the 2nd century in the Christian era when one Sextus Empiricus produced an anthology of Greek skepticism, which reintroduced the people of his day to Pyrrho. In the 16th century, in 1569, there was a revival of these Greek skeptics as this anthology was republished. The 17th century, another kind of new radical skepticism in the thought of the French philosopher René Descartes. An even more radical version, a different style of skepticism, but absolutely as corrosive, in David Hume, the Scottish philosopher in the 18th century. In the 19th and 20th century, and I've touched on him already, the thought of Friedrich Nietzsche powered this view that everyone has a bad motive, a hidden bad motive, their will to power, that whatever they're saying to you can't really be trusted because they're trying to get one over you in moves that they're trying to put on you. And we feel that way about almost everyone nowadays, priests, ministers and churches, bureaucrats and governments, land developers, shopkeepers, corporations. We've all been inducted into this style of radical scepticism. The British empiricists and this subgroup called the logical positivists, people like Bertrand Russell and R.M. Hare, they were notable for their high degree of scepticism, again in a different kind of way, where we can only go with something that has made itself evident to somebody's senses somewhere. And these people were the forebears of the kinds of radical atheists that we've seen in recent years. And these are only some readily identifiable high points. I've heard it suggested that these high points often occur during or not long after times of massive social upheaval, usually a war. It's not a one-to-one correlation, but it does make sense, doesn't it? That at times of heightened social unrest, that equals times of heightened suspicion, and that equals times of uncertainty and scepticism. And I think we're in something like that right now. So given that, given this sort of problem of scepticism, I'm going to take another sort of sharp turn into someone I read recently who deals with out-of-control scepticism all the time. And I think his insights give us some clues to civility in general and some clues on how to approach scepticism. So this is a guy called Mick West, a British guy. I might be skating on slightly thin ice here because I might he might be against something that you believe, but stick with it for reasons that will become clear. He debunks conspiracy theories as a kind of a hobby, particularly these ones, something called chemtrails, 9/11 truthers, Sandy Hook false flaggers and flat earthers. Let's not get into the weeds of what those folk believe right now, but he spends a lot of time with people who believe certain things on those topics. And he seems to sit philosophically alongside those British empiricists. He's that kind of guy. And I'm not sure, but I suspect he's not a person of faith. Even so, I really respect how he operates. He says things like this: talk to them, show them stuff they've missed, and don't rush. That's his sort of summary statement of how he approaches these people. Talk to them, show them stuff they've missed, and don't rush. I'll go into that in a bit more detail next slide. And then he makes this really helpful comment about how other people work. Any argument an individual makes is built upon a huge and complex web of personal knowledge and beliefs, both true and false. You have a huge and complex web, and your friend has a different one. You have one huge and complex web, and your friend has a different one. Very, very elegant statement, actually, in epistemology. And so here is an amalgam of his suggestions on how to approach a conspiracy theorist, and I've thrown in a couple little tweaks of my own just to summarise. So firstly, maintain effective dialogue, supply useful information, give it time. You've already heard him say that those three in other words. So what does he mean by these? Firstly, be curious, understand what they are thinking and why. Be respectful, honest, open, polite. Find common ground, list points of agreement, especially unusual points of agreement. Sometimes it can surprise you what you do actually agree with someone that you're discussing with. Validate their genuine concerns and search for the kernel of truth in their position, because all positions have some kind of something that's probably right. Summarise and re-express their position in a way that sounds to them like you've understood them. So sort of am I right in thinking you're saying this? Blah, 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 blah. Yeah, that's it. You've got me. To be able to say that back to someone indicates that you've properly heard them. And he goes on. Oh, sorry, one more on this. Find the demarcation line. With enough conversation, you can start to find the kind of the line where you're parting company with them. And get a bit more specific about the nature of the agreement and the disagreement that you have. He goes on from there, so I won't go through these in as much detail, show them the mistakes their sources have made, things that they've missed about the topic, any other information that might help them, and give it time. Develop understanding. Mention anything that you've learned from them, and foster trust and respect. And you can see how that last set kind of circles back on the good things in the first set. It's not bulletproof. He knows full well that he can't, and we can't bring everyone with us, but that's perfectly fine because these are the beginnings of civility, aren't they? This kind of approach to someone. And interestingly, I was very struck by how much in that list overlaps with the basic training I did in personal counselling many, many years ago. We were taught all of the things that I was highlighted in blue, that when someone comes and they're in some sort of distress, you do all of those things, particularly summarising and re-expressing their position, the way they can understand. So there's just something very, very helpful and human about this style of approach to someone. Now, Mick West's approach here can be useful, I think, for the kinds of discussion that are about some shared interest out there for which we need to settle on a compromise or a solution. Might be water management of the river system. It might be whether and how to transition to a low carbon economy. It might be what tax dollars should go where and stuff like that. These are extraordinarily difficult discussions, but nonetheless, the way you approach them is something like this. But that list might not be scratching where you're itching, because there are some discussions that are not about facts and figures and not about that kind of truth. And so we need to move into that different terrain of identity, interests versus identity. Identity politics is a tad hard to define, but here's my rough and ready suggestion. It's political advocacy designed to impress upon others the uniqueness and the lived experiences of a specific interest group. The demand that the polity, that's, you know, the community, respect, appreciate and accommodate that uniqueness and those experiences and interests, and often using the tools of the state to do those things. And we might also say it's about enhancing one's cultural space, sort of making it possible to take a place in a culture. There's a US commentator who puts a kind of extreme case in favour of identity politics. This Matthew Iglesias thinks that people have identities, people are mobilised politically around those identities. There is no other way to do politics than to do identity politics. So that's a pretty strong statement. Now, we could also say, and without wishing to denigrate anybody, that psychologically it is about using public discussion and political processes to bolster self-esteem. Because at core, everyone wants to be seen and recognised and valued and appreciated and heard. And we can acknowledge that, of course, as a powerful and legitimate drive in human social affairs. But according to two Canadian political philosophers, Jonathan Goldstein, Jeremy Rayner, that does present a somewhat intractable problem. And they put it like this. They believe that identity politics often causes discussion and political processes to kind of stop because, this is what they reckon, identity climates often resist clarifying what they really want, even to themselves. Here's another one. The politics, this is a bit more dense, might have to focus on this a bit. The politics of individual identity is not so much about realising preconceived goals as about often ambiguous claims that express rather than resolve their similarly ambiguous foundations. Bit of a mouthful there, but if you want to discuss that, we can come back to that a bit later. What we can all easily get to, though, I think it follows that when someone's got a claim about identity that they're feeling pretty strongly about, we can listen carefully and respectfully to their assertions about their identity, but we may not always be able to give them what they want. And that, too, constitutes civility. I can, at least, accept someone, whether I agree with them or not. This is a bit of a something that I think's also been lost in our culture, that you've only accepted me if you agree with me. I just don't think that's true. We can accept somebody quite powerfully without necessarily agreeing with them. Now, we're talking about other people and their identity claims. It's very easy, though, to look down at other people's identity claims without noticing what's going on in ourselves. And this is where I want to get to this next thing, the inner ring. Somebody said to me once that you become the average of the five people closest to you. You become the average of the five people closest to you. And a little while back, I read some new research by some psychologist who more or less agreed that you can't find something called the true self in any of us that we all carry around within. You can't find some agreed way to detect authenticity in someone. Sadly, I've lost this reference, so I can't tell you where I got this, but here's the gist of it. What you can find in all of us is a cluster of values that people like to live out or imagine that we live out that other people approve of. According to these psychologists, being true to myself turns out to mean doing what makes me acceptable to an imagined bunch of others. Do you find that a bit depressing that we humans are so shallow? I've been long fascinated by a 1944 essay by C.S. Lewis on this front called The Inner Ring, and what does he mean by that? He means the inner circle, our quest to belong to somebody else's inner circle. We all have this incredible pull on us to belong, and in his view, at our worst, we will do anything, take any shortcut, tell any lie, bend any rule, trade any value, just to belong. This mad desire that comes upon us all from time to time just to become and stay part of somebody else's inner circle. And as Lewis puts it, the quest of the inner ring will break your heart unless you break it. And he doesn't deny that we do need various groups. We do need to be in various groups for various purposes. But, you know, because we are built to cooperate with others and all that. But the way we will do almost anything to be a part of a group becomes what he calls the great permanent mainspring of human affairs, like in a watch, like in a mechanical watch, the great permanent mainstream of human affairs. And he puts the problem even more starkly. Until you conquer the fear of being an outsider, you will remain. I think this is very, very important for working out whether our agreements and disagreements with others are primarily driven by, I guess, the truth or by this need to belong. Because if it's driven by the need to belong, we're always going to be in the wrong kind of fights. And, you know, this problem has long been acknowledged by the Christian tradition. The early Christian thinker Augustine in the 4th century, 5th century, put it like this. There is a kind of temptation which I fear has not passed from me. Can it ever pass from me? In all of this life, it is the desire to be feared or loved by other men simply for the pleasure that it gives me, though in such pleasure there is no true joy. And I think it's really easy to miss and to underestimate how this corruption of human social belonging into the most arrant tribalism drives so much evil in the world. My go-to example on this is from 1961 when the Nazi war criminal Adolf Eichmann was on trial in Jerusalem. His trial was attended by the Jewish philosopher Hannah Arendt, and Eichmann was the person who, with this just terrible precision, was able to timetable tens of thousands of trains that took Jewish people to the death camps. And so Arendt had gone to his trial to try and understand who would do that, what kind of monster would do that. And then as the trial progresses, she's more and more dumbfounded and shocked to realise that Eichmann was no monster, just a shallow man who wanted nothing more than to belong, than to please his superiors and get some status. And she ends her book with this very famous phrase that she, in finally seeing this, she discovered the fearsome word and thought-defying banality of evil, its kind of emptiness, patheticness. So I think it's very incumbent upon us, if we're not going to just be controlled by the crowd, you need to be really quite thoughtful about your moral options. And I'm just going to give you a kind of a very quick thumbnail of a framework here I've been playing with for several years that I find helpful. And I think I've drawn this from the pages of the Bible, particularly the New Testament. And I've written something about it that we'll go into more detail if you want to follow it up later. Basically, that on any matter, you've sort of got a choice between four basic postures. Firstly, just cooperation, relaxed detente towards the plans and purposes of others. Lots of things people do that you can agree with and just participate in and cooperate, no problem at all. There are some times when people are doing maybe a good thing, but with a slightly off set of reasons or with slightly disturbed motives or something like that. And you can participate in it, but you'll be quietly subverting the reasons for why we're doing it. You'll be operating out of joy, hope, grace and generosity when they're operating out of despair, fear, vengefulness or this crazy myth that things are so scarce. What would be a good example? There's lots of legitimate reasons why folks in our society need to be imprisoned. But I can imagine a person operating in that system quite subversively with joy, hope, grace and generosity toward those in prison when a lot of people really aren't. And you're just there as somebody engaging in the project but with a different flavour to why. There are those times, though, of course, when you will need to you need to expose something bad, shine light into darkness, a kind of whistleblowing stance. And then there are other times when you need to go, you know what, I can have no part of this. I need to exit this system, this game, this whatever, to do something better and different. So, armed with all of those beginnings, point seven, we're nearly there. There was, in 2016, these two authors, Adrian Pabst and John Milbank, wrote this book called The Politics of Virtue. I mentioned at the start how politics also operates as a kind of an act of shared imagination. What do we want? Who do we want to be? And in this book, they try to imagine a better politics than the one that we currently have. And, you know, both of these authors are actually really taxing. And I can't do justice to their whole thesis here, and it is a hard read. But I think it's turned out to be a diagnosis that they wrote in 2016 that's very prescient of many of the problems that we're now facing. I won't try and tell you what they think has gone wrong, maybe later. But I've plucked out two of their simplest statements signalling what they think that we need, and even these are pretty dense, but I think you'll get the gist. We propose gift exchange or social reciprocity as the ultimate principle to govern both the economic and the political realms. We argue for a new settlement that is centred on association and mutualisation. We propose a reciprocalist model of sharing risk, responsibilities and resources, wherein reward is reconnected to personal requirements both for varied self-fulfilment and for rendering a social contribution. All pretty big language, but in effect, they're proposing that by being a person of virtue, you can become a high trust person and send some ripples into the relationships and the polity that surrounds you. And they have a little nod to religions, a little bit of a thin kind of word, religion, but anyway, it is religions that tend to propose some overall account of the human essence as teleologically directed by nature in an ethical direction. That's just a big way of saying, when you, I'll just keep it to Christianity. Christianity gives you reasons for why we're here and why it follows that we do and don't do certain things. And in the absence of that, without which the ethical must sink to the level of sentimental and epiphenomenal illusion. Well, what does that mean? I just think of these interminable discussions you'll have with your PNC about the school's values statement. They're always the same. They're always the same. There's like, there might as well be a lotto barrel with 11 words in it and just pluck out seven. Nobody knows why they're there. Nobody cares about any of them, but we just have to have them. And this is the kind of problem that, these guys are referring to in the absence of a really strong, they say religious, I'll say Christian, account of how the world works. And, you know, as I was thinking about all this, my mind kept returning to the wisdom of Jesus in how to proceed with others. And he had a whole new political imagination, actually. And it's worth noting, too, isn't it, that he moved in a time of warring parties, of ideologies, tensions, identities, demands, friction under this Roman occupation that cared not the slightest about the individual. These were extraordinarily troubled times that did eventually give rise to an uprising and then to brutal repression by Rome after his time, but not long after. Yet even so, even given all that, his incredible Sermon on the Mount instructs his followers in a new political imagination. If you remember that your brother or sister has something against you, first be reconciled to your brother or sister. Come to terms quickly with your accuser. Seek good relationships. And the bits that I've left out of that quote, of course, he's saying, put aside your religious duty. It matters less than going and dealing with this relationship. He'll say, let your word be yes, yes, or no, no. Don't tell lies. Just be direct with people. Tell the truth. You've heard that it was said, love your neighbour and hate your enemy. That's just inner ringism writ large, isn't it? She just subverts. I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. You may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. I mean, that whole quote is full of so many good things, including that really powerful statement that we're all in it together under God and under God's heaven. Of course, in the same sermon, do not judge, or you too will be judged. It means the judgment of condemnation here. It doesn't mean the judgment as in judgment call, trying to determine what you'll do. That's different. But this judgment of lacerating condemnation, for in the same way you judge others, you will be judged. I think that possibly has in mind divine judgment, but nowadays I think sometimes he's actually touching on the way we become the kind of person and receive the kind of stuff back in the world that we put out into the world. I think there's a little bit of that in this quote too. So some steps, let's put all that together, some steps towards civility. I'm going to say four things: your virtues, your epistemology, your belonging, your counselling skills. So your virtues, reconciliation, not vengeance. That's what we're going to keep working at in our relationships. Truth, not lies. A little rider here, not all truth. Some, you don't, when we say tell the truth, it really is permissible. There's some truths that are your property that you don't have to share. We don't mean that everything that you have to say every truth, but when you do speak, that it's truthful. Generosity, not condemnation. So that basic demeanor, those settled habits and patterns of action and feeling towards others, our virtues. Your epistemology, don't rely on algorithms. I mean, I think we're all probably across this by now, but we've just got to wean ourselves off this junk, you know, this algorithmic feed in whatever platform we're looking at. And I want to suggest that you deliberately look at and use left and right publications, okay? So a little detour. These are some of the things I try and read, and they're deliberately laid out lefty to righty. If it's in the middle, it's either because they're moderate or because I don't know. What I try and do is, and some of these are behind paywalls, so I pay for some. Sometimes I just don't and just look at the headlines. But one way or another, I just want to try and get a sense of what people are saying across the spectrum and seeing if I can distill some semblance of reality out of it. I won't always get to that. It's better than nothing. And it stops me being in an echo chamber. And I go particularly for the opinion pieces, right? The news stories are often pretty bland, but the opinion pieces are where you'll find different positions on things. And if you give this enough time, you'll start to get a bit of a vibe, a bit of a sense of who's coming from where on this political spectrum. And that one at the bottom, I don't know if it quite works, but you can check it out. It's called Ground News. They're deliberately trying to kind of point to different news stories and how many so-called left and so-called right news sources are addressing it. It's an experiment. It's a worthy experiment. I'm not quite sure it works, but anyway, have a look, see what you think. So back to my list. Hone your research skills. And if you're a person who has access to the CSU library, it's brilliant. And even if you're not a CSU enrolled person, you can come into a CSU library and still search for it. And you can just start to find all manner of really helpful things, you know, in articles, book reviews and books on any number of topics. And it takes time, but it's so much better than relying on your Facebook feed or whatever. And, you know, it's a learned skill to read, think and research. But I think we have to hone our research skills, whether or not we're an academic. Thirdly, your belonging. Monitor where you find your belonging and what you do to get it and keep it. And if you're a Christian person, I don't want to assume everyone here is, but if you're a Christian person, pray for the Holy Spirit to help you discern when your belonging has gone toxic and if your need to belong has started to corrupt you in any way. And, you know, don't feel ashamed about it. It's kind of normal, right? But we've just got to keep bringing that to God and asking God to change us. And the counselling skills, I won't sort of go through all of those again, but the things that Mick West told us about, effective dialogue, careful listening, kernel of truth, useful information, showing acceptance without necessarily agreeing and all that. Now, we might not be able to fix the culture or the internet or the nation. If you've seen that, there's that great, you've probably seen it, Larson cartoon, I think it is. Come to bed, honey, I can't. There's somebody wrong on the internet. We can't fix the internet. We're not going to be able to fix any of those big things, but in all of these ways, we can signal out there a whole new way of imagining our life together in modern Australia, and we can become, each of us, little points of high trust and new hope to those around us. And you just never know what new norms and habits might then begin to ripple and snowball and build and grow around us in the circles that we move in. So that's pretty much all I had to say. I just wanted to put up to, if you want to pick up some odds and ends, I'll put these slides up at this link, a few other little things I've written. The talk will go on the Intellect website, which is great. I'll probably put it up there too, and maybe some other things as they occur to me. So thank you very much for having me.